And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Patty, before we continue on with early pleasure seekers, and you've just played your first gig at the Hideout after Dave Leones saying to you, you have 3 weeks and you get three songs all in a dare. Loved it. But I have a couple of loose threads for you that we've touched upon in the previous episodes of this season that I need you to elaborate on. So first and foremost, I couldn't let this go. When you were describing the first layout of the Hideout at the VFW building in Harper Woods, and the VFW, by the way, stands for Veterans of Foreign Wars, you described it as a nondescript building, like a box with a bunch of, your words, horny teenagers dancing and sweating so much that you could see it dripping off the walls. And you talked about the triangle stage, and you said on the last episode that it was elevated up a little bit. And there was an area where they served drinks and maybe little snacks or whatever. And then you very quickly skipped over this one room. And you mentioned that a lot took place in there, you said very cryptically. So since we are not skipping any details about the pleasure seekers and you and your sister Susie during this time and your friends, Nan and Diane, tell us about that room.
Okay. Well, yes, I love fleshing this out a bit because there's a lot to it and the era. Okay. I'm sure Dave did some side business there and stuff. It was a private room. It's where the bands hung out when they were waiting to go on and stuff, like a dressing room, like a backstage room. And remember, this is an era of changing morality in society. And these are teenagers coming into their own with their sexuality and lots of behaviors and controversy within society. Birth control approved in 1960. So you have these teen male bands. Now, pleasure seekers didn't do anything crazy in the back room, but yes, there were hookups. Absolutely. We knew this. We heard the gossip and the talk about it. You know, it was teenage boy bands having fun. And you know, this is the era. I mean, you're teenager, loose and raging hormones. This is the early inception, early of counterculture burgeoning up. It was all happening right now. And the hideout was right at that mid-60s where it was really coming out a lot. And they were experimenting with drugs. So there was drugs,
That's what I
LSD,
was. Hold on,
and
because you're saying so many exciting things. Hold on. So I totally get the burgeoning sexuality. I mean, I think that's of any generation, although with what you're saying, the music especially was tilting toward the feelings of immorality with rock and roll and all of this supposed scandalous music. But it is well, let's just say, mid to late 1964. So we're still a little early. But you're saying drugs. Were there drugs? And if so, what was happening?
there were drugs, Valium, marijuana, LSD, you know, common things, the hippies trying to understand themselves. And this new music, it was like music and mayhem. I mean, everything was starting to bubble up, even with the drugs. And you know, they would take the drugs. I'm sure there was drug stuff happening in the back room. Nothing like horrible, but those were the three that were popular, you know, the marijuana, of course. And the LSD, you know, they think about their music and what they wanted to say and trying to understand their situation. It was music and drugs, and it was a new type of communication. It really was the drugs and the music. You had the British invasion and Motown in the back, but this whole new thing was exploding right then. So all of this came into fruition. Absolutely.
So you had said a lot on season, well, you said it on season one and season two, and I will often tease you about it, even to others, that you were in this moment, as you say, this burgeoning moment of music and drugs, and let's just add sex to it in the back room. But you were pretty straight yourself in terms of drug use and drinking and all of that, in terms of sexuality. You're saying you d were the pleasure seekers seeking pleasure backstage in this room, or were you underage? You were underage, so how did all of that work?
Well, I know that some of the girls, you know, maybe were a little bit looser with the sexuality. I was pretty darn straight. I was like an anomaly, you know, to that era, because I never did the drugs and I wasn't like obsessed with the sex. Did I have sexual experiences? Of course, I was a teenager, but not very often. And my family, we were pretty straight. Okay, so I mean, Mary Lou and Diane was fairly straight too. You know, she had her boyfriend and all that. And Nan, I think she was a little more loose with it. Mary Lou, I don't know. I don't know. And Susie, you know, she experimented with the drugs a little bit and stuff, you know, early. I don't know how early, I'm trying to remember. She had a boyfriend, a regular boyfriend. So, you know, that took care of that part. And I mean, it's all in her books. I think her boyfriend was her first guy, you know, and she was pretty solid with him, high school sweetheart. So, you know, and on it went. But no, we weren't some loose female band, you know, having it off in the back room. We just weren't.
Well, a couple of thoughts on that. You had said that Nan was a year older. So if she
Yes.
was maybe a little bit looser or more, whatever, that makes perfect sense. So she was 17. But I'm curious, you being straight, using your words to all of this, I mean, not totally, but did this have anything to do with your upbringing as a Catholic or just your personality or both?
Well, my mother was terribly religious. My dad, not so much. I'm not sure if it had to do with our upbringing or the fact that we were a little scared of that. You know, we're five Catholic girls getting into music. Dad read us the Riot Act on all the things that could happen. I mean, you know, he educated us. So we had, I would say, a healthy fear of going, making a left turn into the wrong direction. Okay, I think that's what stopped me So, I can't say about it. Nan was so popular. She was gorgeous, blonde, So, she did whatever she did. I don't know. We didn't really discuss it a lot even. We were just involved in doing our music.
Well, it's interesting because you say the Quattro girls or the girls and the pleasure seekers were not necessarily out there having sex and all of that. But you know what? I will say
Two.
what?
Two
Say
of us at that point,
at that
just two
point.
of us. Yeah.
True. But I will say when you say your family was not very, was a little more conservative, I would say everybody but your brother, who
Yes.
is very proud and vocal of how early and with how many?
Oh, Mickey. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He would have been in that back room all the
He
time.
probably.
That was Mike.
When he comes back and joins us, we have to ask him all about that back room because also he was there more in the later 60s when everything was just in full
Yes.
glory. So we will get there, but I just wanted to clarify that. Okay, so.
And you got to remember that Mickey in LA was a bit spoiled, being on that TV show, Lawrence Welk, and he had all these women coming after him. He was a cutie. So, he got into that, what is the sex thing was all about fairly young. Yeah. I'm not
Beyond barely.
surprised from being in LA.
Yes, really young. I mean, he shared it with me, and I think I will save that. But yes, really young. But also, let's add, he was a cutie pie. He was a star, for lack of a better way of putting it. He was a celebrity, and he had a lot of money
Yeah, he
because
was
of
doing
Lawrence.
fine. He had fun.
Yes, he
LA
did.
was his stomping ground for a while.
So let's get back to some of the loose threads that we've been talking about in the season so far. And I just, well, it kind of picks up on a conversation we were having last time. So I recently saw a photo, it was a real photo, black and white, in a Facebook group about the hideout in Detroit. And it was of a little girl. I mean, she could not have been more than 3 or 4. So it's obviously not you, but it was so timely, based upon our conversation, because this little girl is standing in front of an old TV, a 64 TV, and she's watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And the person in the Facebook group wrote, quote, "This is what led to the garage bands, which led to the hideout," close quote. And of course, I immediately thought of you and you seeing the Beatles not only on TV and then live, but I just wanted your take on a reflection on that because that clearly is such a strong message about Detroit and what was happening with the Beatles and the influence and then the hideout and the garage bands.
The entire nation was tuned in, the teens, to see this Beatles sensation on that TV show. It was huge PR and huge expectations. And I'll tell you an interesting story about it. Glenn Frey, right? Glenn Frey, 1964, in high school, taking piano lessons. His aunt, Virginia, an older lady, took him to the same show to see the Beatles. We talked about this. We would hang out at Dan Tana's in LA when he was in the Eagles, later, years, way later. And we would share our memories of Detroit. And we both had to remember that we had the exact same response. He was there with his aunt. He was looking around at all the delirium and crying and screaming. And he went home. Quit piano. He was focused like I was on the band and like, wow, really, thinking about it. What was happening? What was this? He went home, quit the piano, and took up guitar and started his first band called the Subterraneans. And he had a phrase for the hideout. He said it was like the end of the rainbow, the hideout clubs. He said it was all about the hideout clubs. He was the first band he saw there was the Fugitives, same as me. And he ended up working with them later. He was also, everybody wanted to be recognized and hired by Dave Leone and Punchy for the Hideouts. So, that was everybody at that moment in time also was patterning themselves. These bands coming in, Mitch Ryder was older. Okay, he was already classified as the soul greaser band and playing different places. And so every band wanted to pattern themselves after him, but also with this little mix of Motown in all of our background. So it was an interesting time, those years, because, the bands, they didn't want to necessarily be heavy rock and roll all the way. They had all this influence coming into them. And Mitch was like the example of one that was getting attention. So it was very much in our minds as 64 came in and all this.
Had a dream come true. But now I look and you know what I see. I see the girl that was meant for me. And
that's why
you're gonna be mine, girl. You're gonna be mine. And
that's why
you're gonna be mine, girl. You're gonna be mine. I have loved many a girl. This I know is true. But now that I have got you, girl, I'm not gonna let you slip on through. You may be falling in love with you, child. I know that I didn't. But now that I am in this way, you bet your money that I'm gonna stay. And
that's why
you're gonna be mine, girl. You're gonna be mine. And
that's why
you're gonna be mine, girl. You're gonna be mine.
And good for his Aunt Virginia for bringing Glenn Frey to the Beatles.
Thank God. Oh my God. I mean, there's such a history there with him to tell later, with him and his involvement with Bobby Seger. And I mean, there's so much, all these people just, mixing. It was like a wave exploding.